Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
Hi, everyone. My name is Chris Cousins, and welcome to Inside College Soccer. Just before we get going with the podcast, where we interview my good friend Paul Jennison, I've got Don Williams here, my colleague. I just want to talk about the event that we've got in Las Vegas in February. Don, let's find out more information. Can you tell us all about this Las Vegas Goalkeeper Showcase, please? What's it all about?
So Andre and Luciano and I were talking about, you know, the problems with identifying goalkeepers at games is that they often don't get a lot of action. So we wanted to be able to showcase the goalkeeper's abilities before the tournament starts, and then coaches can identify the goalkeepers that they want to go see and track throughout the event.
So how's the day going to run, or how's the event going to run?
So we'll bring them in the night before, 5 to 7. We're not going to beat them up, but we're going to allow them to show a little bit of everything: chips, crosses, driven balls, distribution. We'll be very careful on the 1v1s. We don't want to hurt them, but handling, shot stopping, tips, allow them to be able to showcase everything that they can do for an hour or two before the college coaches, the ones that are eligible to shake hands with coaches and meet them. They'll be able to do that, introduce themselves beforehand. And then coaches can then make notes, go out the next day and the next couple of days and track those goalkeepers.
What are the coaches saying about this event? I mean, I've heard positive things, but what have you been hearing?
Yeah, we did just a little release, not even on social media, not even really saying what it was and what was involved. And we already had coaches reaching out going, yeah, let me know when it is. We want to come because coaches also know through their experience that this is a problem, identifying goalkeepers during games, because they may not get a lot of action.
So how do you sign up for this?
So there'll be a link attached to this, and then you can always go to www.srusasoccer.com, click on events, and you'll see a link to be able to sign up for this. Primarily, this will be SRUSA clients who will just be covering insurance. But for everybody else, it's $125 for the event. We're going to be flying in staff from throughout California to come in. And then Andre will be there from Las Vegas. All goalkeepers on staff running the event, so we can make sure that there's a quality opportunity for goalkeepers to show themselves at the event. Well, hey, everybody. Welcome back to Inside College Soccer. We're back, settled down after the convention. A couple special guests. Chris, I hate to call you a guest, but we don't have you on very often. So we've got Chris Cousins in England, our SRUSA founder. And we've got Paul Jennison. And Paul is out of Florida. Currently working at the IMG Academy. He's a goalkeeper guy, so I'm always happy to bring on goalkeeper guys. Hey, Paul, how are you?
I'm doing well, Don. Thanks very much for having us on. And I didn't realize that Chris was not often on the podcast, so this is a treat for myself as well to be on, you know, be a special guest with him for your talk. He's, here.
He shows up every once in a while to help us out with some different projects. Hey, Chris, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Just if I got the invitation to come on, I'd be on every week.
Well, yeah, that's got to be my fault then.
Time difference, right?
Time difference makes it tough. What is it, Chris? 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock?
Yeah, 8:15 right now.
Yeah. So Paul and I are laughing, and Paul's in the sunshine of Florida. How's everything going there, Paul? You guys out of the hurricanes and all that stuff?
Yes, very, very fortunate that luckily where we are, that wasn't too much of a direct hit. Unfortunately, some of the state did get quite badly, but we were very fortunate that it didn't. But we hopefully seem to be moving forward from that. Everything's been great down here on our end. South Florida, definitely a great place to be right now. Great weather and a lot of soccer going on around here. So enjoying the sunshine, no doubt about it.
So, Paul, how did the journey begin? How did an Englishman come over to the United States and then end up staying and working and coaching in college? Let's just kind of start at the beginning a little bit.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you. I had a bit of a non-conventional journey in terms of a lot of the coaches over here. You know, it's actually 20 years ago this August that I first came over without wanting to date myself. And Chris, that probably puts us very close to each other. But I went to school up in Peterlee, which is south of Durham and north of where I was in Middlesbrough back in England. The idea was they specialized on getting athletes out here on opportunities to play. Came over in 2001 to play the original Mike Rose Classic in Memphis, Tennessee. And really that kind of to set the process in motion. 2 years later, I found myself at a junior college in Champaign, Illinois, which is where it all began at Parkland College. Had a fantastic 2 years there. My sophomore year was probably my best when I met a certain roommate who was, you know, without doubt, a Rolls Royce of a centre half back in the day. The John Stones before
Alex
John
Moody.
John Stones. That's right. That's right. Alex Moody.
Not me. Yeah. Just a backstory. Me and Paul went to college together. There we go.
See, there's the connection. But had a great 2 years at Parkland College. Met some phenomenal teammates. You know, got to really enjoy the American experience. And from there, after two great seasons on the pitch and graduating with an associate's, I ended up at the Division One school that was down the road, so to speak, Eastern Illinois.
Paul, just to jump in there, you've got pretty fast. How did you end up at Parkland? Just to kind of, I know you went to that Mike Rose thing, but like, how did you actually literally end up at Parkland? Just to kind of jump, if you can remember that far ago, that long ago.
I can remember that far ago. It was actually purely by chance, because as I know everyone right now, when they're doing their college highlight reels, puts up a simple link or just sends out the information. Back then, we were sending out VHS videos to people. And we had a game filmed on a Thursday in the pouring down weather, and I thought nothing of it. My team that I was playing for at the time won 2-0. And I had a teammate of mine that had been trying to come out here and find various ways of doing so. And he'd sent the video to a coach, and it just so happened to be picked up by our college coach, Seamus Riley. And he'd seen the video, and the player in question and myself both received an email the next day asking if we'd had any interest. And I told my family that the first school that had showed a positive interest in me and given me that opportunity, I was going to take and show that same investment back. So luckily, Parkland was the first one that came forward, and that's really where it ended up happening.
Who was the friend? Chris Nakubu?
It was the very man, yes.
I still speak to him. He's married to the Hulk's daughter. Do you know the original Hulk? There we go. Lives in LA now. There we go, little... Do you remember? I can't remember his name, but yeah.
Lou Ferrigno.
That's the one, yeah. Right.
That's the one. Yeah, he's got two kids with her, and yeah, their granddad's the Hulk. There we go.
That's not bad. That's a good story, isn't it? So we've both done all right now. Our journey's out here so far.
He didn't go to college the other day. He ended up staying, and
he did. He found a different journey out.
Yeah, and I turned up a year after you. And then, so how do you do in junior college? What did you find... Tell us a little bit about the junior college route. What do you think about it? Any sort of, positive, negatives, what are you finding?
To be honest with you, I didn't see any negatives at all. I thought, and you know, it's easy in hindsight now to look at people's experience, but in the junior college realm, we had quite an international and diverse team in terms of players from all over the world. Obviously, you know, 20 years ago, it maybe wasn't as common to have an Englishman on your team. So I was certainly enjoying a good cultural shift of living in mid-central Illinois, which was a great life experience for me, and being based on the University of Illinois near their campus. But in terms of playing, we played against some very, very high-level teams, Merrimack College and Flow Valley, which were located in the St. Louis area. Very, very talented players. Again, the training regimen, the fitness expectations, the academic standards were all the same as any other division. So we found that was quite eye-opening. And again, obviously, with having the coach from where we did, he held us to the highest standards, and accountability was nonstop. So I certainly loved the experience. I got to play for 2 years. I got some very positive accolades as an individual, which I might not have got had I gone into a school that had more established and upperclassmen dominated. So I was very fortunate in that. I was very lucky to be an all-conference and all-regional goalkeeper. And because of that, like I said, you know, it kind of set me up nicely moving on to that next level. I had 2 years under my belt. So even though my junior senior years maybe didn't end up exactly like I wanted on the pitch, I was certainly in a far more positive position maturity wise to handle any situation thrown at me and had a bit more resilience than maybe I would have had I gone in there as a young player right out of high school. And I think I would add too, you know, I did it a little differently in terms of I didn't start my freshman year until I was 20 years old, which I thought for me gave me a little bit more maybe worldly experience going in there, living away from home rather than just kind of having that first time out of the house, moving to a new country and really having that experience taking me over.
There we go. Paul, we hear all the time from parents, mostly American parents, that it's so not fair that a 20-year-old comes in from England and then an 18-year-old from the United States has to compete against them and they don't stand a chance. It's not fair. International players should not be allowed in the United States at 20 years old to compete against freshmen. So what would you say to that?
It's a brilliant question. I think you probably get somewhere deeper into the philosophical point then about development over the opportunity to win and what is college sports? Is it about winning or is it about player development? And I think obviously a way the lot of the competition is set up, the objective is to win games and to advance. If you have a player that's already gone through a large amount of that pathway and is ready to step in and perform in a performance-based environment, you know, that they're often the players that should have that opportunity. I don't think it should necessarily be a domestic born or an international. I really don't think that comes into the question. I think it should be about players that can successfully navigate the academic and the athletic situations they're in and find a way to execute all those at the highest level. And again, I think the argument could be the same going the other way. If somebody from the United States was ready to go into an English academy and perform, I think they should have that opportunity also. I would see no reason why that would be a concern.
I like that. And my answer is always very similar. So my own son went over to England for 2 years straight out of high school. So he came in as a 20-year-old freshman. And I tell American parents, your kids can do this too. There's academies all over the world. There's different gap year setups all over the United States and Europe. And their kids can do it too. But the parents and the kids are choosing to go to college straight away at 18 and not experience gap years and exploring football in other countries. So the fact that, you know, American parents and kids make that their choice and then get upset that somebody else took advantage of the rules that are already set up to allow for that gap year, I don't think it's right. And then as a former college coach, and you too, former college coach, when somebody says you have to win or you get fired, then to say, but you're not allowed to choose the players that you want to choose within the rules, it's not fair to coaches either. So you went on from Parkland, and where did you end up next, you said?
I ended up at Eastern Illinois University, which is about 35, 40 minutes away in Charleston, Illinois. A smaller Division I school in terms of, you know, population and attendance, about 8,000-9,000, I think, at the time, but competed in a very good conference. We were in the OVC back then. The MVC, I apologize. Our women's program was in the OVC, and we had some great games against the likes of Creighton, which were producing top players going in the MLS draft. So we were getting to compete on a regular basis against some of the highest quality in the nation. Again, having that chance to go and play in maybe a bit more of a smaller school where you were more well known and not necessarily kind of swallowed up by attendance and having fast pace around you, I think was probably something I found myself, especially academically, very much enjoying. Everyone's, of course, got their own process. But I thought that the team we had was very tight-knit, a good background of individuals. And again, I had some good competition in the goalkeeping realm, especially going up against one or two guys who I probably wouldn't have had the chance to anywhere else in the world, but certainly pushed me to find out my best position and my best attributes towards that.
Paul, remind me who the other goalkeepers were.
So I competed at the time when I was there, my junior year in them, I got to compete against two other guys. It was Mark Hansen and Nick Alexander. I remember them very, very well. We were quite an eclectic group and we had very, very different skill sets. And I think it was very, very interesting to what we all brought, you know, culturally, because of my background, I was a bit more of an organizer. And I thought there was a bit more of the direct approach when it came to the vocal piece. And of course, as Chris will tell you, Don, you know, growing up, you have to be able to ping a ball. So that's something I thought I had in a bit of a skill set where I was able to distribute around the pitch, maybe before it was popular, or long ball, as we would like to call it. Whereas I probably was let down a little bit on a couple of things where the other two flourished. I'll never forget, Mark was phenomenal in the air. Best box manager I've ever seen at the collegiate level. And Nick was the most agile and explosive goalkeeper I'd ever worked with. So in terms of a core of goalkeepers, we complemented each other well, you know, but ultimately it was always down to the head coach and the manager, so to speak, to pick what was necessary. Sometimes my number was called, sometimes it wasn't. But at least going in there, I was 21, 22 years old. So like I said earlier, I was a little bit more ready to navigate that that hardship of maybe not being in the team and also not letting my lack of playing time be a negative influence on those around me.
Yeah, how did that experience affect you? So you ended up coaching, right, in college?
Yes, that was after the fact. Once I graduated from Eastern, I ended up, my degree was in physical education and health teaching certification. So I think like most of us that get done with the college game, we always think we can explore the professional route. I probably wasn't on that track, hand on heart. My habits weren't aligned with the goal. So therefore, I wasn't in a position to do that. I ended up with a teaching offer in the west suburbs of Chicago, which in hindsight was the best thing that ever happened to me. I ended up as a PE teacher and a head boys varsity coach at 25 years old. You know, later that year, I ended up as the girls head varsity coach. So at 26, I was getting repetitions on the pitch. I was managing people, managing a staff, building relationships, failing far more than I was being successful. But I wasn't putting down cones and I wasn't making opinions without anything to back it up. And looking back now, by the time I was 30, I'd lost far more games than most people ever get the chance to compete in. And it really was just setting me up for a brighter future. And I think it also, you know, I was far more well prepared to talk to some of my athletes at the time about the highs and lows of the college game, the ability of what it means to get in the team and keep your place there, and also give them an honest answer about what they can do to earn the time that they're looking for.
Yeah, and that was kind of where I wanted to go with the question, because I love it that you were a success at Parkland. Things went exactly like you would hope they would go. And then you end up at your next school and things don't go anything like you would hope they would go. How did you think that affected your development as a coach and how you interacted with your players that maybe were in that similar situation, right? What advice were you giving them or would you give to kids that go in and don't get the opportunity to prove themselves? Maybe you're just part of the team, right? But don't get that playing time that they want. Because we see this a lot, right? We see this a lot with players in the United States. They go in for one semester. They don't get to start a play. They go, I want to transfer. They're just starting to look. They're just looking for the places they can play. And that tends to be the current trend, right? It's much easier to transfer now than it was when you were.
Absolutely.
Were you a player? So what advice do you give to your players? What do you tell them? What would you tell them because of your experience?
Well, I think the overlying piece, and it's another brilliant question, the overlying piece for me, and I guess looking back then, and it's easy sitting now as a coach, but, you know, my value wasn't based off my playing time. I guess, to use that term from back home, a bit more of a senior pro, even though I wasn't a senior per se. I was one of the elder players on the roster. I had a bit more understanding of what it meant to enjoy the process and not equate everything with my minutes on the field. So for me, I was very well aware if I wasn't in the team, there was a lot of the younger guys that were looking at how I acted. You know, was I still showing up every day to train with a certain mentality and trying to earn it back, or was I going to sit on the sidelines and complaining? So I was very conscious of that. Plus, the reason I was there is the head coach had clearly valued me and brought me in. I thought I owed it back to him to at least put that same effort and intensity back in the program. And also, I think I was fairly smart in realizing the other goalkeeper was playing better than me. He was in the team because he was helping the team win. So I had to be smart about that too, that my job was to keep pushing him and make him play well. If he was doing that and staying in the team, fair play, because we were winning games. And then the mood in the camp, so to speak, was fantastic. You know, my job then was to just wait until my number was called. Sure enough, that did happen at part of the journey. And of course, luckily for me, I'd practiced for weeks on end without any, you know, playing time reward. And then the flick of a switch, I was in the game and I had to perform. And that's really how it works out. And I guess to answer the other part of your question, you know, I think from a goalkeeping perspective too, when you're talking to, sometimes the most difficult positions to manage are the number two and three goalkeeper, because it's just a completely different psyche and what is necessary to be successful. You know, your number one's obviously getting a lot of the prestige and the accolades, whereas your number two, you've got to constantly keep on edge and performing, whereas at the same time, never let them lose focus of the fact that their number one job is to support the guy in goal or the girl in goal. And then on the flip side too, that number three goalkeeper, I think it's the most difficult position in football, because you've got to be the most positive, upbeat, and, you know, supporting teammate, knowing that you probably will get very little reward from it. So for me, just being able to manage goalkeepers moving forward, from my experience, it was invaluable, because I'd had real life application. And hopefully that's something I'm still continuing to offer now when I talk to the goalkeepers in the youth game about those same criteria.
You just to jump in there, Don, sorry. You touched upon like your habits didn't align with like maybe turning pro or whatever. Don, am I right in saying you're doing a podcast with Erica about like you can give us 110% but might not be enough and you've got to kind of be happy with that?
Yeah, that's actually, we're recording this on her podcast on Friday.
Oh, there we go.
Andre and I will be on.
Yeah, see, I knew I heard that. And obviously Paul put that in, and I was interested to know like one. Because I hear all the time and we see all the time, people like are just desperate to turn professional. The odds are against you, right? And that's fine. That's anywhere in the world. But some people can't handle that. Like what, if you don't mind me asking, Paul, what sort of, I'm not saying specific habits, if you want to name them, that's fine. But what made you realize that you probably haven't got the next, you can't go to the next level playing wise, and what brought peace with that, I guess, if you can answer that, I don't know.
100%. I think for a lot of collegiate athletes, being 18 to 22 and living away from home, the call of social life and trying to be involved with a group and trying to balance everything that goes with a college experience. You know, my nutrition wasn't the best. I loved the weight room, but my recovery after it wasn't particularly positive. My sleep was limited. You know, again, my prehab and what I did on game day was very, very necessary and needed. And I love that. But at the same time, I don't think I lived the life off the pitch as much as I did on it. I think that's very easy to say now, because ironically, 20 years after the fact, I take care of myself like I should back in college. But at the same time, I think, you know, I also realized as I was going through the experience that the academic piece for me was something I began to love. And when I first came to the States, it wasn't a priority. So that also shifted in my life, that realizing I wanted to be a teacher, and especially in physical education, that took a lot more of my time and energy. And because of that, you know, again, I had talent. I was good at moments, but unfortunately that wasn't enough, because the one or two people I were competing against they were just as good as me. And they maybe did one or two things in their power that I hadn't. So I think it's the off-field living of your life, you know, your recovery, your nutrition, your sports performance, all these things that really allocate the majority of your time to help you be successful. And like I said, I think sometimes people are naturally gifted and can make it work. Sometimes people like myself who are good, you know, that's as far as you're going to go without going the extra mile. And I probably listened too much to what other people were doing off the pitch and didn't focus on myself. That would be my honest reflection.
It's crazy looking back in it. Like, obviously, we lived together for a certain amount of time as well. And I always look back and I don't have any regrets, but, and not to take over your podcast, sorry, Paul. But like, it's like you think, oh, we didn't take it serious, did we? Like luckily you kind of broke through. I missed opportunities after Parkland. I had various opportunities, but missed out on them and stuff. And part of that reason was because not taking the off pitch stuff serious. And yeah, we can only like look back and like have regrets, but it's kind of like sharing that now with people saying like, look, if you're going to go into this, like, take it serious on and off the pitch. And it's easy saying that, and you can get caught up in it, can't you? Do you know, if you're an English lad in America and you've landed for the first time living away from home, it's hard in it, but it's also, you get caught up in it, and it's just one of them things. If I always believe people will make it if they're good enough. Some people might make it if they just put a bit of effort in, and most people just don't have that extra 10% you need to make it. So that's why I wanted to ask about that one.
I think it works the same way. I'm not even sure that after having coached a number of Englishmen and Argentinians and Germans and American kids, I think it's the same thing. I think it's just 18-year-olds, 19, first time away from home, basically.
Yeah.
You're not being monitored anymore. Your friends want to enjoy and experiment and have fun and goof around, and you want to do the same thing. You just want to live life a little bit, right? Without your parents being around you and under their thumb. I think it's just what kids do in general. I tweeted this not too long ago that, you know, if you're not paying attention to the weightlifting and the speed conditioning and the sports psychology bit and the nutrition and all of that, somebody out there in the world is, and you're behind that person.
Yeah, 100%.
And if you're unlucky enough, or maybe lucky enough, because it shows you what it looks like if you do it differently, but you get teamed up with those guys that are doing everything right, you start to realize real quickly, oh, I'm behind. I'm behind. And you know, it's nice to say that we should have 15, 16-year-olds focusing on all of that, but it's difficult. It's not that easy. It takes a lot of work, a lot of sacrifice, and it means you don't see your friends as much. And it means you maybe not going on dates as much, and you're not, you know, living life as much because you're focused in on that one thing. It's that old thing. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. And if you're practicing, you know, 1 hour a day, you're behind the guy that's practicing 4 hours a day.
If you try to tell 16, 17-year-olds, like, you're not, odds are you're not going to turn pro, you're going to ignore it and go, well, I'll be that small odds, which is good, which is what you want. But mm-hmm. There needs to be a sense of realism as well. But that's a whole other podcast. And I'm sure you deal with it every day, IMG. But yeah, so Don, do you want to carry on? So
do you find this affecting your life and advice that you give to your students now, Paul, those experiences?
Yeah, but only in a positive way, because again, you're coming from, you know, I can't talk to the athletes about what it's like to be a professional because I haven't been one. But what I can talk about is the experience of having things in front of me and not been focused towards it, you know, worrying about the noise, so to speak, and being concerned with things that were outside of my control. You know, we only ever, without being cliche, it's the attitude and the application, correct? These are the things that we do. We do control. And I think, as Chris said, you know, if you're good enough, you'll get seen. So for my point is, when we're talking to the athletes about how they live their lives and what they want to be seen, you know, I'm a firm believer that you can't change people's opinions, but you can change what they see. So for instance, if you're dressed professionally, if you're early, if you're set up for whatever the activity is, if you conduct yourself in a way, if you're shaking hands before and after the game, you know, I'm a bit, it's ironic because I wasn't this way as a player, but I'm very much against swearing as a player. And some people will disagree with me on this massively, and I have this debate a lot. I firmly believe if you're swearing around the field that you are losing physical and mental control of yourself. I can't rely on you in that key moment in order to be organized and put your best self forward. And if you can't put your best self forward, you're not going to have a positive influence on the team. And I think especially for a goalkeeper, we're often heard before we're seen, I apologize. So the information you're giving has got to be concise. And I think, again, the presence that you have and the energy you give off is going to be noticed by all. So I think those experiences for me have definitely laid the path for how I like to coach. And please, I would, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't say the coaches I had at the college level, fantastic. Not one thing negative about any of them. They were great people, great mentors, and any success or failure I had was probably down to myself, because ultimately, once we cross the line, it's on the athletes. So I have nothing but accountability on that part. And that's really, again, one of those things I want to promote to the athletes I work with and anyone else listening on your podcast. It's really your actions are ultimately you, not your words. So it's kind of keeping that life lesson and moving forward with it.
Gold. Chris, you just got like three clips out of that need to be pulled out and put up. I really like that. This idea of taking responsibility for who we are and what we're doing is something that some players don't want to do. It's somebody else's fault, right? And I think that's a really important message that you're sending. So when you were, I'd like to talk a little bit about your time at Northwestern, if we can. So what one of the biggest academic schools in the country, I'd say consistently in the top 50 to 60 schools in the country that players name when they think about going to a great academic school. It's a big school, right? Not a smaller school. They've got virtually every sport. We can watch their football team on television, watch their basketball teams play. People talk about them. So because it's such a popular school, it's not a Parkland, right? I don't think any kid in England is saying, I want to go to Parkland. It's like, we haven't heard of it, right? But Northwestern might be on the lips of a lot of kids in this country and even in other countries. As a coach there, give us an idea of like before events, ECNL events or big events, big tournaments, how many kids might be contacting the college staff for you guys to come see them? How did you organize that? What did that look like? How did you decide what emails you were able to open and actually look at the film, and were you overwhelmed? How did that work?
Well, I think for me, just popping into my kind of journey first and then coming back to your question, Don, you know, I'd gone from the high school level where I'd had some success, but I guess on a fairly local stage within Illinois. And then I all of a sudden am given this tremendous opportunity from a head coach and associate head coach who were beyond gracious and mentors to me and opened my eyes to the world in terms of college athletics and gave me full access to their program, you know, realizing that there is such a massive outreach of high-end academic athletes that can succeed in the classroom and on the pitch. And I think for me, that was the eye-opener that you've got players, you've got student athletes performing at a professional level while still preparing for doctorates. It really opened my eyes in terms of, I thought I'd navigated that for a couple of years when, again, I probably hadn't done as well as I thought I could. So that was fantastic. I think the key thing when you're looking at a school like that is you realize that you can't convince people that academics is a strong suit. It's either something you want to do or it isn't. And I think that's ultimately where a lot of the high-end academic schools will, you know they will have the opportunity to find athletes that will fit that mold, because again, some people either want to be challenged with that academic level or they don't. And I think that's perfectly fine either way. So we would obviously have a lot of outreach from athletes, but at the same time, I don't know if everybody truly wanted that level that at the time Northwestern or any of the Ivy League schools or any of the high-end academics would offer. It might maybe just seemed appealing. But at the same time, like I said, tremendous school, and combining that winning mentality on the pitch and in the classroom was something special.
Now I want to talk a little bit about goalkeeping and the goalkeepers that you would be looking for at Northwestern, right? What type of a goalkeeper, how you would identify the goalkeeper, what kind of qualities was it specific things that you needed because of your conference in order to win that you were looking for in a goalkeeper, or was Northwestern looking more at a national level, like we can handle our conference, but this is what's going to happen in the tournament. This is what we're going to need in order to win. So how were you determining what kind of goalkeepers you were going after?
Well, I think there's, you know, this is a philosophical question because this is often where the goalkeeping coach per se and the head coaches tend to have a difference of opinion. You know, whatever the head coach wants, you get. They've got to fit the player profile of the team and of the program. And they might be the best goalkeeper in the world, but if they don't have the attributes within that player profile to execute what the head coach needs, you know, whether that's distribution, I know the buzzwords now are building from the back. And just because a couple of years ago, a certain manager decided that all goalkeepers had to play from the back, we seem to now think that the whole goalkeeping position has changed. When it really hasn't. It's still about keeping the ball out the back of the net. It's about organization. It's about leadership. It's about, you know, first and foremost, protecting the goal and then the area. So I think these are all the key qualities that you want to fit in there. And again, sitting down with the head coach and saying, what do you need to be successful? And then you piece that together after the fact. You know, my role was very much to prepare them for 5, 10, 15 minutes to be successful in training. And then from training to the game, it wasn't necessarily about the goalkeeping coach or the goalkeeper. They had to be the 11th player, first attacker, last defender. And I think that's why, you know, coining a little bit of the phrase for goalkeeping coach is now defensive coordinator, to use the American lingo. I think you really are, because you have to realize how they impact not only the individual realm, but units and team shape. And if you can do that, I think ultimately from a developmental standpoint, you've got to make sure that, again, the player profile of the goalkeeper fits exactly what the head coach is looking for.
So when you were you sent out to tournaments or to events to actually evaluate goalkeepers in person?
Yeah. Goalkeepers, field players, whatever it would be, you know, all a fully inclusive staff of the recruiting process. Yes.
So when you were looking at goalkeepers, you and I both know that when we are going out to a match to see a goalkeeper, we may not get to see them do all of the things that we need to see them do to know if they're going to fit into our style of goalkeeper that we want, right? They may not have a lot of action, or maybe they don't get any crosses on the day, or maybe there's not a lot of back passes on the day. How did you solve that problem when trying to evaluate goalkeepers?
It's a great question. There was two things I always look for, and it's still something I would advise my goalkeepers on to this day. Pre-game warm-up. For me, I know everything I need to know about you and how you warm up prior to the game. If when nobody's watching, you are casual, you're not engaged with your teammates, you know, the equipment's all over the place, you're taking your time to put your gloves on, you don't seem focused in the activity, that tells me that when the pressure's on the line, you won't be performing. So that the pre-game warm-up, the cleanliness of your actions, you know, the ability to work with the goalkeeping coach, the other goalkeeper, whoever it is, that's first and foremost of importance. Second of all, if you were not seeing much of the action, if you were not connected with the player in your start position or your ready position, and you were not vocal, then again, that tells me that you're not necessarily as confident in your own ability to help the team be preventative and stop issues within transition. So that then tells me that maybe the soccer IQ and game knowledge has still got room for improvement. And I think then, obviously, everyone's a good shot stopper. It's like being a good center forward. I would hope you're scoring goals. It's running on the outside, you know, running as an eight. It's just a prerequisite of the game. You know, the other areas can be coached, but I think that the planning and the preparation and the engagement, they're things that are very often you either have or you don't. And it takes a certain willingness of the goalkeepers to really push their presence onto the environment and be a positive influence.
Yeah, I felt the same way, Paul. You know, anytime I was evaluating goalkeeper, I would get there early enough to watch them actually arrive to the field with their team, and I would start studying them, just like you were talking about. I'd study them as they're getting ready, how they interact, what they're saying, how serious they're taking the match, then watch the warm-ups. Unfortunately, in warm-ups, at least here in the United States, a lot of times it's some guy tossing balls, tossing a couple low ones, and then they just throw the kids into four corners, or, you know, some drill where they're just pounding the kids, and, you know, the goalkeeper's getting pounded with, you know, a shot every 12 seconds, and not ready for half of them, not set for half of them, can't really get into position before the next one's coming in. So I find that goalkeeper warmups at the youth level here in the United States are just very lacking and ability to demonstrate. I think Tony Miola, I don't know that, remember that name or not, but Tony Miola, I read an article from him 25 years ago, when maybe longer, and he said that a warm-up should basically be a mini practice of everything that happens in the match that we see. So we can collect a few crosses, we can collect a few hard shots to the hands and a few dives and a few and check our angles and a few pass backs and a little bit of everything. And I don't know why, after having played goalkeeper for as long as I played, because I never had proper warm-ups. And even after coaching, it struck me as, oh yeah, that's really what I want. That's what it should be. But it struck me as new, as a novel idea back then, 20, 25, 30 years ago.
Just to jump in there, Paul, when you saw a goalkeeper, this is at Northwestern, when you saw a goalkeeper and you liked them, did you, I'm sure there's different answers here, but did you always invite them to an ID camp, or was sometimes it just kind of, we like her, let's get her, or was there a set structure in place with that?
No, that's good. And I think obviously everyone's going to be different in terms of those processes. I'm always a firm advocate that, you know, anyone can have a good game and anyone can look good on one occasion. I was a big proponent of wanting to see someone fail or have a situation in the game where they weren't successful, because it was then the secondary piece was, how are they going to respond, and how are we going to be able to see their attitude and their action to that issue. I don't want to say resilience, because again, it's a game, but at the same time I want to see how they respond positively. So I would say that normally trying to, and again the process obviously since I was in the collegiate game a couple of years ago has now changed drastically. So in terms of contact and early recruiting, it's a lot different. But I would certainly want to make sure that if you can get them to see campus and you can build a relationship and find out if they're a person that would fit your environment. Because again, obviously I know, and we can certainly go into this now, but there's a lot of criteria why people would look for a school. And I think sometimes the coaching staff is obviously appealing and you want to have a good connection to them, but at the same time, coaching staff can change. And the school itself that you're at, you know, that has to be a place where you would be very confident in just being an athlete, just being an academic student as well as being an athlete. And I think you genuinely want to have to embrace that regardless of the coaching staff. And you know, again, because of that, that could be geography, size of school, cost, academic standing, whatever it would be. But I think I would always try and extend the process a little bit, not make snap judgments, because again, we're talking about younger athletes here, and there can be highs and lows within the game. So we want to try and give them as fair an opportunity to be successful as possible.
If a player comes to you who's in that kind of like not elite category, so to speak, just kind of like, yeah, it's a friend of a friend, or like, oh, Paul used to coach in college, or Paul knows some people. Like, right, Paul, where do we start? I'm not asking you to like create like a whole process here, but like, what's your kind of quick few minute like advice for people? Like, where would you start, and what's the process you think for a girl or a guy? Looking for the right college, sorry. I mean,
yeah, no, totally. Some of the things I just mentioned there, I think there's certain things that come into it that might be non-starters for you. So before you even, you obviously want to have a reach school or the dream schools. You want to have that list of what your goals that will stretch your ability and stretch your dream to the highest level. And then you start to factor in all those things, such as the cost of attendance, such as, you know, the academic standing, like I said, geography. Do you want to be far away from home? You know, do you want to live closer? Have you seen the other goalkeepers you're competing against? Do you have any idea of what the level is that you want to play? Do you have any idea of the level of competition? Do you want to travel every weekend? You know, do you want a Division III where they're only playing for 3 months and they don't have a spring semester? So they're all questions that I would encourage to think about. But, you know, ultimately, whenever it comes to the recruiting process, my simple advice is this: go where you feel valued. And that could be at a junior college like I did, where I felt like I was the best goalkeeper in the world, and I hope I paid that back. Or at the same time, you know that there's a plan for you. And I think now, unfortunately, with the transfer portal like it is, and obviously still having some adjustments to what happened a couple of years ago with the pandemic, schools are trying to figure things out. And I think sometimes maybe that it's a bit more difficult to give you a plan over the next 2 to 3 years as an individual. So I think that my advice is always, you know, speak to the coach, build a relationship, find an honest answer, and go somewhere where you feel as though you're going to be the best version of yourself. And they're going to be able to help you get there, most importantly.
Would you suggest ID camps? Would just pure email? Yeah, I mean, Northwestern obviously used ID camps, but did you use them for recruitment or money? I'm not trying to lead you down a path here, by the way.
No, totally.
I'm interested.
My thing was this. Any ID camp I've ever done, I've coached. I think they're valid questions to ask. Is the head coach going to be there? Is the goalkeeping coach going to be leading the goalkeeping element? I think that's massive for you as a goalkeeper going into any ID camp. You want to know that the eyes on you are the ones that are, that whoever's evaluating you is the one that is going to ultimately be taking care of you. So I think that's a very, very fair question to ask. You know, I think it's brilliant to know is within the recruiting realm, of course, and the rules for NCAA, is the email somewhat personalized or is it just a genuine blast email? If you're using the camp as a chance to get in front of coaches and build confidence and kind of get that equity in yourself, absolutely fantastic. But if it's a school that means a lot to you, I also recommend that you're ready to play when you get there. So, you know, maybe pick the time that you feel as though you've got a skill set which is going to showcase you well. And I think that's often helpful. Don't go in as too young and too untested within the game. And then their first impression is not what you truly want to have across. So I think timing is everything within the game. And again, don't just rush on a random weekend where you're going to be missing team activities. Make sure you plan it where you're not disrupting everything about your life just on a chance. Because ultimately, like you said earlier, you know, if you're doing well on the national stage, people will know who you are. So you've just got to stick the course then and trust the process that you're doing the right things.
So do you think you got to play at these, as Don calls them, alphabet soup leagues? Do you have to be a good player? Or, I mean, I'm guessing Northwestern went to the major showcases / events. Any snippet of information you'd give some advice there? Like, would you say to people, play at this sort of level or not? Or what would you think?
No, I think, sorry, you said something on the screen. I think, if you're on the national showcase, people are going to see you. If you're a good goalkeeper, people are going to know who you are. And the way that the US is set up now with national, regional, you know, league play, there's always top clubs in your area that if you're doing well, will be interested in you to get you back on that national platform. So I think that the top schools that are doing it right would not just pigeonhole themselves to an MLS Next or an E64 or a Girls Academy or an ECNL. They would have sufficient networks of players and coaching relationships where they're getting information about those gems, so to speak. Again, past experience tells me that sometimes those players, they're performing to the highest of their abilities and they just need to be put in the right environment to be successful. So I think, I know that's a bit of a generic answer, but ultimately my advice is if you are playing in the top leagues and the national showcases, you're always in the views of everyone else. But at the same time, yeah, the shop window, so to speak. But I also think if you are a top player and you're playing in a lesser league, you're going to stand out. And as a goalkeeper, why would you want to be on the best team in the nation? I'd want to be in a team where I'm getting worked 80 minutes out of the 90 and I'm getting to showcase my skill set constantly. And if you're losing 4 or 5-0 and people are talking about how well you've played, you know, that there's some merit to that rather than winning 1-0 and you didn't touch the ball.
Before you went to a showcase / tournament, and let's say it's the night before it starts, and someone got all the goalkeepers together. Don probably knows where I'm going with this one, by the way. But got all the goalkeepers together, and it was just a goalkeeper-specific thing. Would you like that? And then it gives you a chance to look at, I'm pitching our thing we're doing here, by the way, just to just get some feedback on. But like, look at the goalkeepers the night before a showcase or a tournament for the weekend, so you can kind of get a close look at the goalkeepers and you can go watch them properly in game scenarios. Would you like that?
100%, mate. Any opportunity you can put them on the pitch, that's where they're going to shine. And like I said, you might well see at the start of that session, it's a more relaxed environment. So they're going up against other goalkeepers who, because it's goalkeepers around each other, it might not seem as threatening because it's not a game situation. You're going to get to see how they train. You're going to get to see those practice habits. You know, I think also on the flip side, because of the way that the you know, the psychological component of the game is. Some players with performance issues are fantastic trainers, but they don't transition that into games, and vice versa. Some goalkeepers struggle in training and they can't focus, but it comes to a game, and gamers is obviously what they're called. Any chance you get, especially for goalkeepers, to put them in front of others to show what they can do is a win-win in my eyes.
Thank you. I'll snip that and use it in our promotion.
Yeah. Check is in the mail, Paul. No.
Brilliant.
Because as we've said already, that the problem is being able to see the goalkeepers in multiple environments to know if they're going to fit inside your environment as a college coach, right? Okay, Paul, because you were on the women's side at Northwestern, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So I've said this multiple times. I feel that there is a surplus of male goalkeepers in this country who are competent, who can go in and do a job, and from all over the world. There's a lot, and probably more than there are really spots for. But on the female side, there's a shortage of goalkeepers that are competent, that can go in and do a good job, whether it's fitness issues that we see, or whether it's that bit of assertiveness that we may not be seeing, or whether it's athleticism that we may not be seeing, that there's a shortage of truly qualified, can play at the best levels or really contribute to the women's game of female goalkeepers. A shortage. Is that your experience, or what would you say to that?
I think in both realms of the game, there are incredibly talented goalkeepers. I think, Don, it comes down to this from the goalkeeper perspective. I don't think there's as good enough differentiating of training based off the needs of your goalkeepers. I think that we often put goalkeepers into a box and say, all of you should be able to do X, Y, and Z. And I think that the reality is within the game, you've got people that have different skill sets that if you were comfortable and confident enough as yourself as a coach, you should be able to take that and drive them forward. For instance, some goalkeepers, they're not going to have a vertical presence. So they're not going to be able to get above the crossbar. So, you know, if they are quick and mobile and aggressive, do you teach them to protect space in front of themselves and defend behind a back line, knowing that, yes, they may give up a goal behind them, but that is few and far between, whereas penetrating passes are probably more likely. And on the flip side, you might have a goalkeeper that's maybe not as confident playing with their feet, but they manage the box aerially fantastically well. So you put an emphasis on that. And I think that's why we go back to those player profiles and what the coach needs. I think there's more than adequate goalkeepers out there at both the men's and women's game. I think, you know, just trying to differentiate the ideal of what you're trying to get out of them. And as a coach, giving them a specific plan of how you can help them get there. Because again, that if you've got 3 to 4 to 5 goalkeepers, the chances of all of them fitting the same mold are very, very unlikely. So you've got to be able to clearly show that just because you see me working with X goalkeeper on this, doesn't mean it's in your best attributes your best needs and wants to be able to do the same thing. You've got a skill set in a different area, which is your strength. And I think that my final piece, obviously, that goes without saying, we spend too much time working on weaknesses, whereas that's only going to raise your game 5 to 10%. If we focus on the strength of a goalkeeper, that can often make them then perform at a higher level, knowing that that's the area of the game they can fully put an influence on the environment with.
I find there's a lot of goalkeeper trainers in this country, but not a lot of coaches. So in other words, we can bring out all the gear and we can just set up all the rebounders but there's not a whole lot of coaching going on. This is why you're not getting to that ball, right? This is, your set is late. Your first step is off. This is what we need to work on. This is where we need to improve. You're in an environment now where you're training good high level kids that are very serious about their game. And you did the same at Northwestern. Are you noticing what I'm noticing?
100%. I mean, more than, especially in the realm of social media now, when everything's about the destination and not the journey. I think it's very easy to click on YouTube, Twitter. And again, Chris will tell you, I'm not exactly the most social media savvy person in the world. So that's probably why I'm fortunate I don't see all this, but.
We're a stalker.
Yeah,
it's the lurker behind the bush. That's what you do.
I don't even know what clicking on Instagram means, but apparently social media is relevant in the soccer realm. And I think it's very easy now for everyone to get a highlight reel. It's very easy for people to make the big saves. It's very easy to do the things that are in vogue and look, you know, they look as though they're putting your best skill set forward. I think that comes down to two ways. One, it's because it's easy to do and kids have fun and coaches want to think that fun correlates with progression. Of course it does, but at the same time, there's got to be substance to it. And two, I think genuinely in the goalkeeping realm now, there's a lot of good trainers that haven't had various experiences outside of the goalkeeping position. And an area I'm very, very adamant about is that all goalkeeping coaches, if you want to continue to extend your career and go to higher levels, should have head coaching and first assistant experience. You need to know how the goalkeeping position, like I said earlier, affects all of the different areas of the pitch. And I think that then gives you that aspect of, you know, the areas we, and I like to promote, is rather than talking about the five realms of the physical, mental, technical, tactical, and psychological, we like to work on cues, actions, and responses. Everything in the game happens based off a cue. For every cue, there is an action and you respond to that action. If you do that, it's always a feedback loop. And again, it comes down to three things also. And in any decision you have in goalkeeping can always come back to these three things: distance from goal, pressure on the ball, weight of the pass. Any decision you make in goalkeeping, and I'm still waiting for someone to challenge me on this, but it can always be looped back to those three things. And if you're designing a session from the game down to the individual piece, if you can keep those things in mind, there's always a justification to the goalkeeper of why you're doing what you're doing.
You're not going to get an argument from me on that. I couldn't have said it any better. It's so true. And one of the quick quip sayings that I heard many years ago from Franz Zouk that I repeated is that goalkeepers don't anticipate, they react. When you start guessing what's going to happen, then you find yourself out of position and you get beat. But that saying that good goalkeepers don't anticipate, they react, feeds right into what you just said right there, Paul. And I think that's gold for goalkeepers and for young goalkeeper coaches that want to get better. You have to think about these things when you're training, because all we're doing is problem solving, right? In training, these are the problems that are coming up in the game that are costing us or will cost us. And then how do we train for these situations to make you more comfortable with them, to hopefully eliminate the opportunities on goal?
100%.
Out of interest, just before you jump on, like, I know, Paul, you kind of brushed past, like, you worked with the ODP and the US soccer centers, right? Regional centers and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Any keepers you've worked with who've gone on, done stuff? Anybody, can you name check anyone?
The one that that had a good career in the MLS that I can honestly say that I didn't really have much influence on him, because he was only with us at the high school level for a year. But I worked with Charlie Lyon when he was first coming through, and Charlie was already on to big things with the Chicago Fire. He came back to play a year of high school, which in hindsight, he was such a good person for doing it, because it probably didn't benefit his development, but he represented his town and his community so well. He went on to have a 10-year career without really being a starting goalkeeper, but he was just the consummate professional. And to be honest, looking at the way he conducted himself, often answered many questions for what it means to constantly drive towards a goal without maybe getting as much reward as you should have got. Because he was absolutely amazing in everything he did. And he's in the coaching world now, and he's someone that I would always recommend young athletes looking up to, because when he was with Seattle, he was working with Stefan Fry and Tyler Miller. And he was just an absolute quality individual through and through. I can't speak highly enough of him. Again, as you said, Chris, working in the ODP level, the Midwest region level, the US training centers, it's incredibly lucky, but I think on my end, it's all about relationship building. And there's one thing I realize more as I go in the game, that the knowledge base is great, but how you treat people and how you hopefully find a way of inspiring your love of the game to others, that's probably what's going to take you further than anything else.
I didn't realize he went to Marquette, actually.
Yep.
I was with a coach.
Had a fantastic career there.
I was with the coaches last week. I didn't, we were talking about other keepers, never even mentioned him, actually. Just wondered. I didn't realize he was 30 years old now. Jesus. God, time.
Stephen Fry thrown in there. So the connection, I love how the soccer world is not 6 degrees of separation, it's one or two. And so Stephen Fry is the same age as my son and moved to Northern California. And I got to coach him at the state level ODP when at his very beginnings, and we could tell immediately. The whole state could tell this kid was going somewhere. This kid was different than everybody else, including my own son, to my own son's dismay, that he finally got his chance at the state level and turned to me, to my son's credit, said, yeah, he's really good. He's really good. Yeah.
So what?
One degree of separation. I love it.
Yeah, I was going to say, is he still at Sounders?
He is.
There we go.
Yeah, he is. He's been in the MLS a long time now. He's got to be coming. If there was talk about him, why didn't he get picked up for the World Cup? And that, because he's had a very good MLS career. Yeah.
There you go. Anyway, quickly to ask about IMG, like what you're kind of doing there?
So my role there is I'm head of goalkeeping, best role in the building. I get the opportunity to work with the boys and girls program. I have two full-time staff members of me, and they're incredible people, great coaches. That between the three of us, we work with our U13 through U19 age groups. We'll have three practice sessions a day between the boys, girls, and then the younger boys and girls on the evening. And obviously, like I said earlier, our job really is to help the goalkeepers with a technical base, but at the same time to make sure that they're understanding the message of the head coach and trying to help them be successful in multiple areas of the game. And I think I heard something recently as well. And in fact, it might have actually been from one of your last podcasts done with Stuart.
Listen, guess where they're both from? They're both from Middlesbrough. They both know each other as well, Don. Stuart Flatty and Paul, the notary.
Okay, all right.
That's the degrees of separation.
Yeah.
Amazing.
But I think he talked about not having a favorite coach. Is that right? He talked about, learning from multiple people. It resonates so much because, again, it doesn't matter where the information comes from. And I thought that was so key. That's a message that we promote between the three of us. If a personality is something that you connect with and you find their information, even if it's the same from three people, but one person's information sticks, roll with it. At the end of the day, it all says goalkeeping on our title. So I think that's the key piece for us. And, we're pretty good with that. So we've got a great group of staff there, great group of goalkeepers. I'd like to think we're getting better all the time. We keep looking for new ways, but ultimately a fantastic place is looking to develop top aspiring collegiate athletes and hopefully some professionals along the way.
This kind of a setup question, because I don't know that there's what the answer is to this, but we've seen the, look, when I started playing, I could pick up the ball from any situation, right? So I didn't need to be good with my feet. So we've all noticed over the past 25 years that playing with your feet, being part of the team, being part of the 11 on the field, has been important. But what do you see as the next progression for goalkeepers, or is there another progression? Have we reached where you see it going? Is there trends that you see happening out there that youth coaches maybe aren't prepared for yet but need to be prepared for?
Well, I think this is a loaded philosophical question. I think it's always dangerous when we base everything off the professional game and then expect athletes that are just starting their journeys to be picking up the same skill sets that professionals are leading with. I think if you start working with a 12-year-old now, to have Edison and Alisson as and I'll use Jordan Pickford for the English example, but as those three with their ability to the feet, that's great. But the chances are that the game will not necessarily evolve. But as you said, there'll be a new trend. I think at the end of the day, it's about keeping the ball out the back of the net. I'm still an advocate on leading with your hands and not going with your feet. I love blocking and spreading. I understand it. It looks great. But why lose mobility when you can save with your hands? You know, I understand building from the back, but why do you want the goalkeeper in possession and your centre-backs in possession more than your 6, 8 and 10? I think there's just certain trends in the game that will change. You only have to look at the English goalkeeping department and you see the big difference. Jordan Pickford is obviously phenomenal in distribution, hands and feet. And then you have Nick Pope, who by definition is probably not his strongest skill set, but you put him with that back four of Newcastle, they don't ever get beaten aerially and nobody's playing the ball centrally into the box. So I think it's all going to come down to what the next trend will be. I think what you will find in the progression of goalkeeping is we'll kind of go back to what the more traditional role was. I would look at Joe Hart and his heyday as the guy that we'll probably see a little bit more of in time coming forward in terms of goalkeepers just simply making saves and playing the ball to the players that can actually influence further up the field.
I can see why you like him, Chris. I like him too. I like you, Paul. You're very... I think that's a very astute answer. I think that was very well thought out because you're right. We do tend to see youth coaches talk about we want to play like Brazil or we want to play like this way. And same thing with goalkeepers. This is what they're doing. So this is what we need to get you ready for when they don't even have the basics now.
And again, it's also, it's about getting success in the game. So I love nothing more than a side volley. I think it's fantastic. But if you had to put your time and energy into dealing with a cutback situation or an angled strike across your body and challenging for a ball in traffic, I think they have far more relevance than what looks fashionable. So I think it's also allocation of time and trying to help these goalkeepers have the overall skill acquisition to be successful in the big picture.
That's brilliant. I like it.
Just a disclaimer, I had no choice but to like him. Our Irish coach went, he's English. There you go.
Put us side by side in two rooms next to each other and said, yeah, you will be friends. That was basically
We'll be friends. And if this was a different podcast, it'd be a whole set of new stories. Should we leave it
players,
on that?
Players, yeah. That one, yeah, we'll save for something else.
Inside College Soccer's After Hours.
That's right, yeah. Keep it PG, please.
Exactly.
Well, thank you, Paul, for spending over an hour with us.
And you've been blushing. You've been blushing the whole way through, Paul. What's going on?
I know. It's only January as well. I hope I hold this for the whole year. Thank you.
Sorry, Don. Carol.
All right. Okay. Thanks, Chris, for setting this up. This is good. We've got some really good advice coming out of this. I can't wait for parents, young coaches to hear from and learn from your experience. Thanks, Paul.
No, thanks for having me. Appreciate it to both of you. And to be fair, Don, to Chris, he's been asking me for the last few years, and I'm normally the one that's got an excuse as to why I couldn't.
You've been hounding me.
Actually, that's the other way around. Yeah, I was asking you to be on this.
I finally got you on. I can leave you. You can leave me alone a little bit now. Jesus.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, no. Chill out a little bit now. Yeah.